Greetings and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, again having Dr. Wolf Eckhard-Loenig on our show, ID the Future, discussing the latest in intelligent design. And today we're going to talk about whether or not dogs could have evolved through Darwinian evolution. Dr. Loenig, of course, was recently on the show. He's a geneticist who recently retired from the Max Planck Institute for Plant Breeding Research in Germany, and he published an article on his website about the evolution of dogs. So, Dr. Loenig, we're really glad to have you back on the show again.
It's great to be with you.
So let's get back into this discussion of dogs. As we discussed in the first podcast, Darwin apologists like Richard Dawkins and many others have long cited the differences between the races of dogs as an argument for macroevolution. Now, in the previous podcast, Dr. Loenig, you discussed how many of these differences between dog breeds and the ancestral wolf are due to loss of function or genetic degeneration and or lead to breeds that have weird defects and diseases that could never survive in the wild. So I'd like to discuss these ideas further by getting into one of everyone's favorite dog breeds, or at least maybe Paris Hilton's favorite dog breed, the Chihuahua. I mean, I think everybody knows the Chihuahua. Doesn't the Chihuahua display an enormous set of differences between itself and the wolf? And could these be evidence for macroevolution?
Of course, they are enormous differences. And again, all these evolutionists, which I have quoted or mentioned at the beginning, miss again the difference in quality. Well, look more closely at a Chihuahua. And there's an entire chapter about health disorders. The first sentence in the internet about health disorders is, this breed requires expert veterinary attention in areas such as birthing and dental care. Chihuahuas have molars, or a soft spot in their skull, and they are the only breed of dog to be born with an incomplete skull. Now imagine a wolf born with an incomplete skull. What would be his survival value in the wild? Chihuahuas also have risk for hypoglycemia, a low blood sugar, which is especially dangerous in puppies. Chihuahuas are prone to infection of the eye and eye injury due to their large, round, protruding eyes and their relatively low ground clearance. Collapsed trachea is a health concern that is characteristic of the Chihuahua breed. They are sometimes tricky eaters, and care must be taken to provide them with adequate nutrition. Imagine a wolf with such problems. Chihuahuas have notorious problems with dental issues. Chihuahuas also are known for the genetic condition called luxating patella, but this can also call many other dogs. Well, Chihuahuas are also prone to some heart-related disorders, such as heart murmurs and pulmonic stenosis. I'm always quoting from that article. Chihuahuas, along with other miniature dogs, such as Chinese Crestheads, are prone to physical deformities. Now I may ask our listeners, well, a wolf born with an incomplete skull, displaying a tendency to hydrocephalus, being at risk of hypoglycemia, a wolf with a collapsed trachea, and being prone to some heart-related disorders and physical deformities. A wolf with a mouth so small that the teeth are overcrowded and for which dental care would be a must. Well, I think Wang and Tedford are correct when they say, quote, these various traits, they speak of the normal variation in dogs, not only of Chihuahuas, these various traits have no survival value and would have been quickly eliminated if they were to occur naturally. I would like to quote Dawkins now with some revisions again and some additions. Dawkins said, bear in mind this order of change due to a series of genetic and anatomical dysfunctions. And Dawkins again, and then extrapolate backwards 20,000 times as far into the past. And Dawkins continues, it becomes rather easy to accept that evolution, he said, from a fish into a human would be not a difficult thing. Quote him again, it becomes rather easy to accept that evolution, now the correct inferences, from a fish into a human has never happened at all. This would be a possibility on the basis of the argumentation of Richard Dawkins concerning the dogs.
So, Dr. Loenig, how does recessivity imply losses of gene function?
First, I would say that many of these differences of the dogs compared to the wolf are due to recessivity. And there are also some dominant. We will speak about that later. The important point is, I'm quoting now James D. Watson on this question. The recessive phenotype often results from the failure of mutant genes to produce any functional enzyme. Recessivity is generally due to the loss of a function on the gene and enzyme level. We have already mentioned the Dachshund, or Dachshund, as we say in German. This is dominant, but is this a better and new function for a wolf in the wild? A wolf in the wild with drooping ears and such short legs would probably have no survival value in the wild. And now look at Sharpei. There's also a 16.1 kb duplication, and he is prone to a Sharpei fever. And there are many points which could be mentioned concerning this topic alone. The Rhodesian Ridgeback, also a well-known race of the dogs, it has a 133 kb duplication, and it often has a dermoid sinus, meaning a tubular indentation of the skin with hair and keratin in the lumen. And it has also an entirely PhD thesis about the Ridgeback, and showing the diseases that can be associated with this duplication. On that internet page, I quoted a list of duplications with a disadvantage for human beings and also a disadvantage for dogs. So duplications do not mean automatically that it is something better, something that is more highly integrated, something that functions in a more selectively advantageous way.
So to what extent is inbreeding involved in the origin of dog races?
Yeah, this is a very important point. The dogs have been bred often for some extraordinary features. And when you have such an extraordinary feature due to some loss of function or some disturbing gene duplication, if you want to breed it true and you want to have a new dog raised with that new feature, you have to do, of course, inbreeding, not to lose that feature again. So inbreeding is important in the origin of the dog races. And you know, of course, that inbreeding can mean that if you have semi-lethal or disadvantageous genes, then some features due to disadvantageous genes can be found in the progeny of these races. And that's probably one of the important reasons that domestic dogs segregate more naturally occurring diseases than any other species.
And Dr. Lohner, you mentioned Eberhard Trommler, who is one of the fathers of cynology, the study of canines in German-speaking countries. What does he say about mutations in dogs and other domestic animals?
Well, he's one of the fathers of cynology, canine science, and he says directly and unmistakably, all mutations known to us up to now are nothing else but mistakes of nature. If we take the original wild type as the yardstick for the domestic animal, and I think that he is essentially correct. All the features, the phenotypically features, which can be clearly described and which are important for distinguishing the dog races, are exactly these mutations which have the quality Eberhard Trommler has mentioned.
And Dr. Lohner, what about gene copy number variants? Do the gene copy number variants and single nucleotide polymorphisms in dogs prove that macroevolution is occurring in the descendants of the wolf?
Well, the answer is quite short. There are no new genes, no entirely new functional DNA sequences, no higher functional integration is gained. So this cannot be argued as a proof for macroevolution.
And are there recent experimental examples of wild-type forms that can produce large variation due to losses of functions in a very short time?
Think of mutation breeding. The collection of mutants in the plant world, well, one hoped that recombination breeding would be substituted by mutation breeding. but this was not successful. Starting from a almost homozygous population of plants, and you can use mutagenic agents of different kinds, and enormous amount of variation has been produced. I myself have done it for two plant species, and I've worked with two further plant species. There was a rather homozygous pea line and other lines, and you have an enormous amount of phenotypic differences, 99% due to losses of functions. In annual plants, this can happen in just a few years. For example, dwarf. How many dwarfs? I do not know how many I have isolated on the experimental fields due to mutations. But when you sequence these things, it's normally losses of functions. And this can be compared in certain aspects to the dwarfs, which have arisen from the wolf and which we now like to have as pet animals.
Now, why is the origin of dog races by large mutations in reality problematic for the neo-Darwinian perspective if all mutations were quote-unquote positive?
Even if all these mutations were positive mutations, gain of functions in the sense of new DNA structures, new DNA sequences with functional significance, higher integration, and so on. It would be still problematic for neo-Darwinism because it was Darwin himself who said, natural selection can act only by taking advantage of slight successive variations. And he added, this is a direct quote, Darwin, he said, she, nature, can never take a leap, but must advance by the shortest and slowest steps. And it was Stephen Jay Gould who has worked on that point. It is Franz Mayer who says it is essentially the mutations with slight or even invisible effects on the phenotype, which are important for evolution. And all these saltations are an exception which are not relevant for macroevolution. He was always polemically denying saltationism. And there are several reasons for that. The important point is neo-Darwinism works with slight successive variations, the selection of slight successive variations, not macromutations. And all these, or almost all these big differences between wolves and the different dog races, from wolf to chihuahua and pinky and what have you, are due to macro mutations. So this is very strange that they are now polemics against macro mutations for more than 1.5 centuries at least. And now they quote macro mutations that prove for macro evolution. And these macro mutations are usually due to losses of functions or disturbance of a normal development. And both cannot be really quoted and could not give an argument for macroevolution.
Dr. Lohner, this is a question that I've always been interested in myself, but how does a comparison of the placental wolf with the marsupial wolf show the improbability of the origin of species by mutation and selection?
I'm quoting now from the book of Mayer et al., Explore Evolution, and they put it very clearly and concisely. These two different groups of wolves have independently evolved from a common ancestor. And if you compare these groups, there are many really astonishing similarities. You find a figure in that PDF paper of the skull, for example, and many other features, down to very minute features. They are very similar. And all these features are thought to have come about independently of each other. The marsupial wolf is thought to have gained these features independently of the placental wolf. Now quoting Mayer et al., 2007, from their book, Explore Evolution, Convergence is a deeply intriguing mystery, given how complex some of the structures are. And they are really complex if you compare the marsupial with the placental wolf. And they continue, some scientists are skeptical that an undirected process like natural selection and mutation would have stumbled upon the same complex structure many different times. So it is not only the same complex structure many different times, it is a series of complex structures which natural selection and mutations would have stumbled upon. Well, this is really very improbable. I think this is one of the most improbable things to believe, that independent mutations and selection have produced an animal which is so similar to the placenta wolf within the marsupial group of animals.
Okay, Dr. Lonig, well, this is the last question for the podcast here, but given these examples, could you please compare neo-Darwinism and intelligent design concerning the origin of basic types of animals and explain why you are of the opinion that ID is a valid science belonging within biology?
I would first refer the listener to your positive testable case for intelligent design by Casey Lusk in 2006 and 2011. And of course, to also give them more than a reference, I would say, if you compare these two groups, the placental wolf with the marsupial wolf, there are so many features showing specified complexity. There's an enormous amount of specified complexity. And also, very probably, also an enormous amount of irreducible complexity involved in the production of the placental wolf and the marsupial wolf. That, in my view, only intelligent design can adequately explain this amount of complex features of these two animal groups.
Well, Dr. Lonig, we really appreciate you showing us why dogs do not make for a very good argument for Darwinian macroevolution. And I, of course, I want to remind that Dr. Lonig's article on this issue is available on his personal website. That's www.welonig, that's welonig.de. So that's www.welonig.de. And you can, of course, find a lot more information about this issue in Dr. Lonig's article. Dr. Lonig, we're running out of time here, so I just want to say thank you for your wonderful work and for explaining to us why dogs, rather than providing an argument for macroevolution, provide an argument for intelligent design. I'm Casey Luskin. Thanks for listening to ID the Future.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.